Well, good morning, TNC family, on this third Sunday in August, where today here I want to talk with you from the scriptures about three statements that reflect bold and wise ways of thinking and living, that if you see yourself living in alignment with them, then I think you can also have reason to believe that your life is in the process of or is about to expand and improve and go deeper with things like friendships, worldview, purpose, and joy, and so on. And all three statements come from just a few verses in the book of Esther. Her story was the subject of an entire church service a few weeks ago, although we did not talk about what we're going to talk about today. So I'm excited to sort of add to the conversation if you were there. And if not, no worries, this is all standalone stuff. And here's the brief setup. Xerxes, we know from history, was the powerful king of Persia for 20 years around 475 BCE. And under his rule, the empire was by far the mightiest power in the ancient world, dominating the map all the way from India in the east to Egypt in the west. And we know about his life from Persian written records and from archaeology, buildings, carvings, and coins. And the scriptures, too, tell a story from his life of how he gets mad at his current queen for disobeying his order. And so he gets rid of her, after which he holds an empire-wide competition where 127 women are brought into the royal harem, paraded before Xerxes, and he chooses the girl who pleases him the most. She will become the new queen. And one of the contestants is a young Jewish girl named Esther. She's an orphan girl. She's lost her father and mother. She was adopted and raised by her cousin Mordecai. And so she's a woman in a male-dominated world. She's a Jew, although she hides this fact for a while. In a world where Jews were in the minority, they had been brought to this part of the empire 80 years earlier as slaves and generally did not enjoy the same social or economic privileges. And she did not grow up with either of her parents, who died while she was young. But Esther wins the beauty contest and is crowned the next queen. And then later, through a set of events out of Esther's knowledge or control, Xerxes signs into law an edict that all of the Jews of the land will be exterminated beginning in the next year. Remember, Xerxes does not know she's a Jew. And cousin Mordecai is the first to hear about this new law. He lives and works in the king's palace, close to the king. Chapter 4 and verse 1 tells us that when Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. After which, it becomes quite clear to him that if the people are going to be saved, it's going to have to be up to Esther. And so he goes to Esther and says, "You're going to have to go to the king. You're going to have to turn this whole deal around." And then she, in effect, responds with these three statements that I want to talk about. Three bold and wise ways of thinking and living, which she doesn't just say them, she follows through on them, and which ends up saving her people. Three statements. And they're the three statements that I think can be enormously helpful for us in our era, no matter what situation we find ourselves in. So let's talk about them. Here's number one. First statement, I am not a victim. I'm not a victim. A statement rooted in chapter 4, where Mordecai says it first, and this is probably the most famous verse from the entire book of Esther, verse 12. "And who knows but that you have come to this position for such a time as this?" And Esther takes in that statement from Mordecai, and then she comes to see the truth of it. Yeah, none of this is my choosing or my fault. I did not choose this situation I am in. And she doesn't blame God either. She doesn't believe God orchestrated her parents to die and that God wanted her to be at the physical and sexual mercy of Xerxes. But she does come to understand this. Like it or not, this is my reality, And I have to deal with reality as it comes to me. And so I will not look back and see myself as a victim. Rather, I will look forward and see the opportunities. Maybe I have come to this position for this opportunity. She says, it's true, I'm in a position nobody else has. And so I have an opportunity nobody else does. Which brings us to the first bit of wisdom now for our day. TNC, your current situation may or may not be one you've chosen. And if your situation was dumped on you by others, you have the right to be upset and to rant and to dislike all of what got you here. But you also have the responsibility to decide, will I live as a victim of something that happened in the past, or will I deal with reality as it sits in front of me today and figure out the opportunities that are in front of me? Which brings me to a woman named Africa Brooke. I was introduced to her last month in an interview I listened to on a podcast out of London. And I do not agree with everything she said, but after the interview, I was so impressed that I bought her new book titled The Third Perspective, Brave Expression in the Age of Intolerance, published just 4 months ago, in which I don't agree with everything she says in the book. But to not listen to her perspective is honestly just to be silly and arrogant. And so when I was studying the story of Esther last month for the church service and then listened to this interview in the same week, I saw so many similarities. Africa Brooke was born in Zimbabwe at a time of great oppression there, an oppression that drove she and her family to emigrate to London. And so they moved to London where they were minorities, immigrants, living in abject poverty. And soon, Africa said, she found herself an alcoholic, age 14, and imprisoned by her addiction, completely at the mercy of her cravings for alcohol, which got worse and worse and worse as the years progressed. But now listen to her own words from this interview just last month. I'm going to cut and paste a little of it for clarity, but these are 100% her words. Quote, I'm from Zimbabwe, the south of Africa, and I was born and raised there where the general population is truly oppressed. I'm from a background and a culture where there's true, genuine adversity. There's no denying it. It's just the reality. But something that I'm grateful for, to my parents and for just the way in which I was raised, I was never raised to see myself as a victim. Even when we came to the UK and there was very obvious racism, we were never made to feel like victims. Even when we were on the poverty line, my mother never said to me, this is because of our race. This is because we're immigrants. Later, by others, I was told that because of the color of my skin, first of all, that I should lead with the color of my skin, and then I should lead with the fact that I'm a woman, and then I should lead with the fact that I'm an immigrant. All of those things which are identity markers, but also part of the game of victimhood. But I never connected or resonated with it. Although there was a time I thought I needed to perform the role of a victim in order to be part of my community, I thought that I needed to have some sort of grievance story about how heavy it was to be a black person in order to connect with other black people in the West, but it was never what I truly believed. And when I would speak to other black immigrants, they would say exactly the same thing, that they didn't resonate with this. To be honest, I discovered this was a very North American way of sort of viewing the world and viewing race. So for me, I find the conversation around victimhood a very interesting one because I can understand that there's some social rewards to it. But I know that from personal experience, I've never seen the rewards of it because it's just never been part of the way that I viewed myself, even though objectively, there's kind of all of those markers of a perfect victim in my life, if you will. It's a fascinating interview. Today, she's an author, public speaker, consultant who has worked for companies like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, Pinterest, Levi's, Sony Pictures, and on and on. And she writes some very interesting and challenging things. But here is her overall point. Yes, you have every right to hate every iota of some of the unfortunate situations you are in. But the single most powerful, liberating thing any one of us can do is say, but today I have a choice, which is to focus on the ways my victimhood is limiting me, or to focus on what is within my control and influence. Because it turns out, TNC, listen, almost always in your situation, there are actions today that are simple and within your control and that will have an enormous influence on how your situation plays out. And if you pay attention to the things within your control and then act on the things within your control, you will begin to develop confidence, momentum, traction, progress, perseverance, hope, results. The recovery community, of course, summarizes this in the Great Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I think that is a prayer Esther may have been the very first to pray, because she says this enormously bold and wise thing. I did not choose this situation, she says, but it has put me in a position nobody else has, and so I have an opportunity nobody else does. Who knows but that I have come to this position for such a time as this? Which leads to the second bold and wise thing she says. Number two, she says, I will consider my life in view of my death. I'll consider my life now in view of my death. This is from verse 11. Esther sends word to Mordecai. Quote, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king, there's but one law, that person shall be put to death. I might die, she says. So I need some time to think about all of this. And she does. She sets aside time to fast and pray and consider her life, about how she wants to live in view of her death. Because death is like this ultimate framing device. Some of you know that the nation of Bhutan, which sits between Bangladesh and Tibet, famously has a very high gross national happiness index. Yep, there's such a thing. And they have a habit of thinking about death 3 times a day. Framing their life in view of death has massive benefits, they believe. And Arthur Brooks, the Harvard social scientist who studies human happiness, agrees. He wrote in 2022 the best-selling book From Strength to Strength, and then last year the book Build the Life You Want, The Art and Science of Getting Happier. And among what he says is that if you want to experience great peace in your life, then you must, chapter 5, ponder your death. Yep, that's what the chapter is called. Ponder your death. Because when you live in awareness of your death, he says, it frames your life. What matters most? How you should think about your time, talents, money, and so on. Ponder your life in view of your death. And how would you do this? Well, there's lots of ways. Here's how the psalmist did it in the scriptures. He looked up at the night sky. Psalm 119, consider the stars. Here's another way. Read poems. No Man is an Island by John Donne. Because I Could Not Stop for Death by Emily Dickinson. When Great Trees Fall, Maya Angelou. And watch thoughtful movies that address this. Read great books about this. I've read at least 3 or 4 times. Night Comes, Death, Imagination, and the Last Things by Princeton professor Dale Allison. It frames your life. Here's another good way. Don't be afraid to talk about it with folks. Because when you think and talk about it appropriately, and this has been the experience of thousands of others who have written about it over generations, you will begin to develop an enormous respect for the mystery and the complexities of life and human consciousness, and you'll run into stories of people who have faith in the face of death and hope in the afterlife, which gives you boldness for your life. And then you'll see all the confidence of Jesus in his own faith in God. And all of these things, they'll shape the kind of things you live for, which stands in opposition to much of what our culture tells us to live for, going all the way back to, I think, about that popular table game I played growing up. It's in the Smithsonian today. It has sold hundreds of millions of copies. The Game of Life, which essentially, if you don't remember or haven't played it, you start with a little peg on the board, and the entire game of life is accruing material things and accomplishments. So eventually you get your high school diploma, and then, if you're doing it right, your college diploma, and then, if you're doing it right, you get a car, and then, if you're doing it right, you get married, and you get stocks, and you have children, and you buy property. And literally, the winner of the game of life is whoever dies with the most accomplishments and toys. But what if the game of life, TNC, what if it didn't have to do with how many houses you had or how much money you have in the bank? Listen, what if the mark of your life was how you pursued wisdom and demonstrated humility and kindness and compassion? Like, what if their bank account had $1 million in it, but only one episode of forgiveness and generosity? But what if your bank account, yes, has less money, but what if it has a whole bank full of episodes of forgiveness and generosity and compassion and love and growth? And by the way, on the authority of Scripture, you won't take with you your car or your baseball cards or the $1,000 you have in the bank, but you will take with you your joy, kindness, humility, positivity, and the person you've become. One of my favorite teachings of the late, great USC professor Dallas Willard was his teaching on these things that we'll take with us to the next life. Quote, "What God gets out of your life is the person you've become. When you meet God face to face, he meets the person you have become. That's what you take with you." And this is what Esther thinks about and does. First of all, she says, "I am not a victim." Secondly, she says, "I will consider my life in view of my death." And then she says, number three, "So I won't be immobilized by doubt." I will not be immobilized by doubt. So she decides, verse 16, quote, "I will go to the king, even though it is against the law." And then these words, "And if I perish, I perish." Because doubt is a bad life philosophy. Because after she fasts for 3 days, I might want to actually fast for three more to make sure that the first 3 days were right. Or at least until the weekend, or maybe I'll move on that. How about January 1 when I start doing New Year's resolutions? Or, yeah, let me check first my bank account. Or maybe we can just pray about it a little more next weekend. See, at some point, living in doubt is just postponing living. Jan Martel, he makes this point in his best-selling book, Life of Pi. Maybe you saw the movie based on the book. He says, quote, "To choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation." It reminds you of that story of Jesuit philosopher John Kavanaugh, who in 1975 went to work for 3 months at the Home for the Dying in Calcutta, India, where Mother Teresa was. He was searching for an answer to his spiritual struggles and uncertainties. And on his very first morning there, he met Mother Teresa. "And what can I do for you?" she asked. Kavanaugh asked her to pray for him. "What do you want me to pray for?" she asked. He answered with the reasonable and humble request, the very reason for which he had traveled thousands of miles to India in the first place. "Mother Teresa, pray that I have clarity." "No," Mother Teresa answered, "I will not do that." "Why?" Kavanaugh asked. Mother Teresa said, "Clarity is the last thing you're clinging to and must let go of." "But you always have clarity," he responded. Mother Teresa laughed. "I've never had clarity, but what I have always had is trust. So I will pray that you trust God." And here's the point. TNC, you will have doubt. It's part of life. But don't make doubt your life philosophy. And don't wait to commit your heart, mind, money, time, and energy to something good or someone until you're 100% certain of everything. Because there's going to always be questions. And it would be great to know for sure all the answers, especially about God. But in the words of Paul to the church at Corinth, "Now we see but a poor reflection. Then we will see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." Paul says you're not going to know fully on this side of the grave. But until that day, I can't go through life trusting no one, calling everything a conspiracy, searching for what I disagree with in every conversation or every book I read, curling up in the fetal position, sucking my thumb, locking my door, and just aging. I have to decide. How will I live? I have to make choices. I have to give my life, my one and only life, to something. I only get one life. Which always reminds me of how in my late 20s, I took drum lessons from a great drummer, a guy named Brett. And the thing about playing the drums is there is grip and hand position and striking a snare or cymbal at the right time, in the right way, to the right degree, for the right reasons. And I remember a lesson where he was getting frustrated at me, at my hesitancy. And so he said something that I'll never forget. He said finally, just hit the blank drum. Just hit it somewhere. Because he knew if I refuse to ever strike the snare, then there will never be any rhythm. And if I refuse to play a note until I'm certain of perfection, there will never be any music. And TNC, if you don't want to go to the grave with all of your music in you, you'll have to go for it. You'll have to put it somewhere. And these are the three brilliant, bold, and wise statements from Esther. Number one, I'm not a victim. Number two, I will consider my life in view of my death. And number three, I won't be immobilized by doubt. Let's pray. God, I pray now for everybody listening. I pray that the words of Esther would become our words, and that through the power of your Spirit that is available to us right now, we would be infused with hope and possibility and courage and purpose, because you are always with us. You'll never leave us, and you will never forsake us. And now, TNC, I pray that the Lord would bless you and keep you, that he'd make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you, that he'd turn his face towards you and give you peace. Amen.